That's right. I forgot.
Good morning. Thank you for the warm words of welcome. Notably missing was Reish Kol de Skoki.
Lishaovar.
Okay. How quickly they forget. I wanted to discuss a case that is not a practical case. This has not yet come up in the Beis Din, I can tell you. However, it is a real case, something that probably touches this community more than many others. And that was the famous gefilte fish controversy of 2010, which I see many a blank stare as I mention that. So let me explain the gefilte fish controversy. It goes back a few years. At one point, my children announced that they wanted to have a pet. So they negotiated. They wanted a dog. I wanted to give them a plant. You know, it went back and forth. So we finally decided on fish. Fish seemed to be the way to go. Just a little tie-in. They all eventually died on one of our trips to Chicago. As we left them at home for 2 months untaken care of. But that's neither here nor there. What is relevant is when you get fish, there are these algae eaters. Anyone who's ever had one? They're basically these yakisha fish that walk around cleaning all day. Yeah, it's one of the great inventions of all times. That you put this fish in, and it just sits the whole day cleaning up. You don't have... It's a wonderful idea. So based on this concept, back in the 1970s, 1980s, when they began to do fish farming down in Mississippi, they had these great tubs where they would grow their own salmon, etc. It became necessary to clear out those ponds also. So they got these monster size fish that also basically did the same thing. They eat algae all day. So they had to import these fish. They were known as Asian carp. I think now maybe people might begin to ring a bell a little bit. And these Asian carp, which are not native to the United States, were brought in and they were kept in these pools where they would just basically do the job of cleaning up. It was all good until 1993 when the Mississippi River overflowed. And when the Mississippi overflowed, it overflowed into these pools and that allowed the Asian carp to escape into the Mississippi. And that's not a good thing at all. As you may have heard in the news here, more than we hear in New York, I'm sure, these Asian carp are destroying the ecosystem of the Mississippi, and they're making their way up the Mississippi. Asian carp can grow up to 100 pounds each. They eat about 50% of their weight every day. Do the math. That's almost as much as a typical yeshiva guy. That's a very significant amount we're talking about. So these Asian carp have made their way into the Mississippi. If you ever got time on your hands, go on to YouTube, look up Asian carp. They have this bad habit that whenever they hear noise, they jump out of the water. They weigh 100 pounds. They break people's bones. It's a fascinating thing to watch unless you're in the boat. So these are these Asian carp. They're making tsarish and kamohu, and they're making their way up. And over the next 10 years, they make their way all the way up to Chicago. And they're in Chicago, and if you can get past the Chicago locks, you get into the Great Lakes, and if you're in the Great Lakes, that's it. They take over the world. That's the end of it. Game, set, match, pack up, we should all make aliyah, because this continent's done by the Asian carp. That's the story. So what are you going to do to get rid of the Asian carp? This is a major issue, and there are different approaches. So they start dumping poison into the water. They electrify the locks so they can't get by. Everyone has different ideas. So one idea which they're going to try is eat them. Why don't we get people to fish and eat them? So the government starts encouraging people to stop fishing for Asian carp. And they said, no limits. The more the merrier. Get all the Asian carp that you can. We'll give subsidies. Start catching Asian carp. So there is a company here in the Illinois area, Schaefer Industries, and they start doing this. And by the year 2010, 2009, they are catching 12 million pounds of Asian carp a year. Now the question is, what are you going to do with 12 million pounds of Asian carp? So Asian carp, it ends up, they don't taste so bad. They're very low in mercury. They don't eat other fish. And a fine source of protein. And son of a gun, they find a major buyer. Israel buys Asian carp. Why? Because Asian carp, people don't like to eat it because they look disgusting. But they don't taste bad. And they're cheap. So therefore, Asian carp, who are kosher, would make great gefilte fish. No one knows what your gefilte fish looked like before. They look like balls. That's what they look like. Right? Right? Anyone else that book, The Five Little Gefiltes? You know what they look like. It's not a big deal. That's what we're going to do. We're going to send them to Israel for gefilte fish. And in fact, they're shipping it in 2009. They sent out 12 million pounds. And the plan is for 2010 to send 36 million pounds. This is being strongly encouraged by the United States government. And as such, the price is dirt cheap. The price for Asian carp is 90 cents a pound shipped to Haifa. Now, that would seem to be wonderful for the gefilte fish consuming public of Israel. However, it's not quite as good for the fishermen of the Kinneret. The fishermen of the Kinneret, who previously were holding the gefilte fish monopoly, cannot produce fish at under 90 cents a pound. That's just not possible. So the gefilte fish fishermen go and they complain to the government that, you know, this illegal dumping of gefilte fish on the Israeli market is causing them irreparable harm. It's going to permanently damage the fishing market of the Kinneret, and therefore the Israeli government has better take action. And the Israeli government does take action and puts a 120% tariff on Asian carp, raising the price from 90 cents a pound to basically $2 a pound. $2 a pound, the Kinneret fishermen can beat that easily. As such, Schaefer Industry gets a call. They say, we're not interested in your gefilte fish anymore. Now, they've already have all this fish. It's frozen. It's being ready to be shipped. Two containers are already sitting in the Haifa port, and they get the news of this. So there's a panic. So the panic leads to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton picks up the phone, calls her Israeli counterpart, and says, either you drop the tariff on our Asian carp, or we're going to put tariffs on Israeli technology. And with this, a full-blown trade war breaks out. The great gefilte fish wars of 2010. And America very much, besides protecting the American jobs here in the great state of Illinois, they are even more interested in just getting rid of this fish. There's only one other potential customer, and it's Haiti. Haiti needs protein, so maybe Haiti will take it. But the bottom line is, they want this to go for the gefilte fish. And a full-blown war breaks out. I wanted to spend some time discussing who's right. Who's right? Is Israel or America right? Do we pass like Israel or Hillary Clinton? Does Israel have a right to put these types of tariffs on their gefilte fish in order to protect the jobs? Or no, is free trade the way of halacha, and therefore that's the way to go? So from the very basis of this, a tariff is a tax. We are now approaching the 100th anniversary of the federal income tax, if you haven't heard yet, a day that we assume we won't say Tachanun. Like, all right, that sounds like a good enough reason. So the question, the people said, for 100 years ago, the United States of America is much older than 100 years. So how did we make a parnassa before we started the income tax? So the answer largely was tariffs. Tariffs, whoever wanted to import into the United States, we took a cut of that. And that was enough to keep the whole government running for almost 150 years. Tariffs, at the end of the day, is a form of tax. So the first step is, does the government have a right to tax? That's the most obvious question. And it's very interesting, if you look at a Mishnah in Bava Kamma, which is number one on your source sheets, it just happens to be there, what are the odds? The Mishnah talks about, Ein poritim lo meitevos hamuchsin v'lo mikis hagabayim ve'inotum hem tzedakah. So it talks about the muchsin. Who are the muchsin? What's muchas? Muchas is tax. It says if a taxman comes to you and they want to make a donation to tzedakah, they want to make a donation to the shul, or if they want to change money with you, you shouldn't take it. Why? It's dirty money. The taxman doesn't have a right to his money. So it sounds from there that there is no right of taxation. That's what the Mishnah seems to be telling us. However, if you look at the Gemara says that doesn't make sense. Says, don't we know that the government has a right to make laws? And in particular, what type of law are we talking about here? It would seem we're talking about taxes. The number one thing that a government does is taxes people. Right? You have to have defense, you have to have roads, you have to have schools. There are certain things that the country needs. If we waited for everyone to chip in a few dollars for the army, it wouldn't work. Right? Therefore, you need to have taxes. So how can you tell me the tax man, what he's doing is illegal and you can't take his money? It would seem from here that of course he can tax. What do you have against the tax man? So Reb Chanina bar Kahana mer Shmuel b'muchus she'en lo kitzva. So one answer is that taxes are allowed if you're collecting for something. Right? We have a budget. However large the budget is, there's certain things that the government decides that it's important for us to pay for. And therefore, they need to raise that amount of money. What if they want to tax more than that? What if the king just wants more money? So that's already an illegal tax. There's a limit. You can only tax the money that you need. Rav Yana says that's a different story. We're talking about a person who's collecting taxes for himself. It's not for the government, for everyone in general. Okay. Gemara goes and gives another very interesting case, a case that's interesting for other reasons. So there's a machlokes, so you're not allowed to wear shatnas. But let's say I'm going through customs. And customs says if you're bringing in products to sell, you have to pay taxes. But if I have the shirt on my back, I don't have to pay. So what do? I wear 15 shirts. Right? Walk through, 15 shirts, 15 pants, however you make it through. Not a problem, right? This is okay. Right? I'm just using it for myself. Can the top shirt be full of shatnas? The question is. Because I'm not really wearing it. I'm not getting hana out of it. In a perfect world, I would not be wearing this. Layering is important if you go on the cold, but to an extent. So what's the story with that? Are you allowed to wear shatnas on it? So why would I be doing it? To avoid the taxes. So the Gemara says, okay, we have a machlokes here. So I understand we have a machlokas about shatnas. Is it that shatnas, you can't be wearing it even if you're not getting benefit from it? Or is it a matter that, no, shatnas, no matter that it's only if you get benefit from it? But let's take a step back. Why did you say you're wearing all those shirts? To avoid the taxes. You're allowed to avoid taxes? Gemara says you can't do that. So Gemara says in the last line on the sheet, are you really allowed to skip over the taxes? Don't we know that this is the law of the land? So again, gives the same answers. Either when he's doing it with there's no amount, either he's doing it because he's doing it for himself, etc., etc., etc. Similarly, it says he has another case that in certain cases you're allowed to lie, say this isn't really mine. One of those cases is for the tax man. Again, you can't pay. So the Gemara repeatedly says that, yes, assuming that there is a just government, and it's collecting taxes in a just way to pay for reasonable expenses, then of course you have to pay taxes. Only if a tax, for some reason, is not just, or the government is not just, that's a question. Now, discussing what is just and what is not just, that could fill many a talk show, right? Is it that every person should pay the same amount of taxes? Is it that everybody should pay the same percentage of their income? Is it possible that maybe that the more money I make, I even pay a higher percentage of my income? Could that perhaps be just or not? Not for now. I'm sure Rabbi Schaff will be happy to discuss it. I don't want to take away his thunder. These are obviously issues that might be on somebody's mind right now. We'll just kind of leave it on the table for the time being. But the bottom line is you have a more general rule is that there is a power of taxation out there. And that power of taxation is pretty broad. Assuming that what's going on here is fair, then halachically a person is required to pay the taxes. Now again, that's an important statement. Because, as we all know, there might be cases out there where people could not pay their taxes and not get caught. So is there a halachic obligation? As a good Jew, should I pay my taxes even though the IRS will never catch me? So it seems to me that the answer is yes. That, you know, just we all partake. We all have our garbage picked up, right? We all are defended by our armed forces. Therefore, halachically, it's not just a matter of, you know, you shouldn't do it because it'll be a chil Hashem when you get caught. But no, it's really, there is an obligation, it seems, to pay taxes. Where does this power come from? Where in the Torah does it say that a person has to pay their taxes? Where does it say that the government has a right to collect taxes? So there are four different approaches to this, basically. The first approach is the approach of the Me'iri, which is number two, which is really based on number three, a Gemara. In Sefer Shmuel, when at some point or another, towards the end of Shmuel's life, the people tell Shmuel, you know, you've been a great leader, we've really been happy with the time you've been here, we'd be happy to present you with a gold watch for your years of service, but at this point we'd like a king. Shmuel does not take it well. Why not? Isn't it a mitzvah? Som tasib alecha melech? Doesn't the Chumash say that? The Rishonim make their living answering questions like that. There are plenty of good answers out there. But among the things he does to discourage is he gives a drasha. He says, you know what a king's going to do for you? He's going to take away your fields because he wants them. He's going to take away your children and he's going to make them go to the army. He's going to take whatever is yours, he's going to walk away with it. That's what you want? Okay. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin wants to know, is he serious? Meaning, when he says, whatever is written, when Shmuel gives this drasha, does this mean halachically the king has these rights? We're just trying to scare him off. So look at the Gemara, says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Kol Amar B'Parshas HaMelech, Melech Mutar Bo. Rav Yehuda says, in the name of Shmuel, that in fact, whatever is written there, he's allowed to do. He's allowed to take away your field, he's allowed to take away your children. Absolutely. Rav Omar, Lo Nemar Parshas Eloyayim Aleihem. Said, no, he's just trying to scare him. Shenar Mar Som Tazim Alecha Melech, Shei Masa Alecha. He wants the people that there should be a certain amount of fear of the king. So therefore, he gives this drasha before him, but the truth of the matter is, no, there isn't any machokas. So this is machokas between Rav and Shmuel. The Gemara says it's also machokas tanoim, an earlier machokas. So the Me'iri picks up on that in Nedarim, and the Me'iri says that ultimately, we paskin, we hold a kol ha'omer v'pashas ha'melech me'elech mutterbo, that really the king has the right of eminent domain. Right, the king has a right to take that which he needs. And since he has a right to take that which he needs, that's what taxation is. Right, the king could come off and say, no, we need, you know, your car right now. My sister lives in Israel, and she has a nice-sized family, and therefore they have one of these large vans, 11-seater or something. So her van has to go on miluim. Mean that in the event that there is a call-up, her husband doesn't go to the army or anything, but her van has to go to the army because, you know, if we're transferring people, they need vans like this. So that's the right of the government. The government could say, you know, okay, we're calling up your van. So just like the government, because we have a need for that, they could also tax. It's the same idea the Me'iri says. The Me'iri says that the right of taxation comes from the right of eminent domain of the king, and therefore that's how we get to taxation. Now that, of course, once you're going to say that opens up certain issues. For example, Tosfos on Sanhedrin points out that this leads to a little bit of a problem. There once was a king, not a very successful king, but not a very good king, called Ahab. He had a wife, Jezebel, and ultimately, even though he basically controlled the world, he got very jealous that his neighbor had a vineyard, and therefore when his neighbor didn't want to sell, he had his neighbor killed. And that was seen as something not very good. So Tosfos asks why. He's the king. He has a right to take whatever he wants. Why didn't he just take it? The guy refused. He was a Moed B'Malchus. He was rebellious. What's so bad? So if you look at Tosfos, so yes, that question, number four. Tema lama nenesh achav al novos, kevin shelo rotzel imcholo karmo. He had the right to take it. He was stopping the king. So that's punishable by death. So Inami, so he gives a few answers. And when he said, the parshas melech o nemer rak al melech she nimach al kol Yisrael v'Yehuda. Me'esa makom v'aychav lo marach al Yehuda. V'gam lo yimelech me'esa makom. So the Gemara, the Tosfos offers an answer. Then we talk about the power of the king. The power of the king is limited to a king who rules over the entire Israel. Now, Achav was already later in Sefer Melachim. At the beginning of Sefer Melachim, there is a split between the kingdom of Yehuda and the rest of the 10 tribes. So therefore, he was the king of the 10 tribes. He did not have the complete set. He was missing Yehuda and Binyamin. So because of that, he wasn't the king, and therefore he did not have a right to take what he wanted. So according to this, taxation would be limited as well. If you tell me the entire basis of taxation is based on the power of the king, a person would have to be a king over the entire Israel, A, and B, it would not be clear at all that a non-Jewish king would have that right, and therefore, basically, the laws of taxation would be irrelevant probably anywhere at this point. So that is a potential problem of going with the approach of, even though it sounded nice, that the government is representative, it's the same power as the king. The bottom line is, if you tell me that the power of the king is that limited, you're going to limit the power of taxation as well, and that will be that. So that's number one. Number two is based on a Gemara. This is the Ramban. Again, we'll skip over one, and we'll take a look at the Gemara in Gittin. And the Gemara in Gittin introduces us to something called Hefker based in Hefker. That the Beisdin, the judiciary system, has a right to make things ownerless. So, give an example, not the most average example, but a good example from the Gemara. So, the Gemara talks about in Gittin that there was a problem. So, let's say, in the Beisdin, one of the things we do is divorces. And divorces, by and large, don't go smoothly. That's the general. There are exceptions to the rule, not enough of them. So generally, when it comes to a divorce, I always tell the following story to students. I say, I don't actually get involved by and large in divorces, but sometimes through my work in the monetary side, I'm involved in the division of the marital estate. We've got to sit down and figure out who owns what and just divide it up. So I always tell them, this is the basic rule you need to know. Let's say you come into a determination that the marital estate is worth $100,000. If I sat down with the people and I say, we have two options here. One option is we in the basement will write a check for $100,000 and you'll both get everything. Option number two is that we could take the entire marital estate, bring it to the center of 7th Avenue, douse it with gasoline and set it on fire. What would you rather we do? Inevitably, they will choose number two, so the other one gets nothing. Right? That's a sad fact of life. But it's reality. So the Gemara offers the following. They said, let's say a husband really wants to get his wife good. So he says, okay, I'm going to give a get. I go and I say, here, I want you to go write a get for my wife. She's in New York. Here's the get. Go deliver it. So he takes the get. He goes off to New York. O'Hare, he's on the plane, and I turn to two people and I say, I'm mevatel the get. I changed my mind. The get's no good anymore. The shliach has no idea. The shliach goes, delivers the get. He thinks it's a good get. She thinks it's a good get. She gets remarried. She has children. The children are now mamzerim, and she's not really married. Ha ha, who's laughing now? That's a bad thing. That's not an idea we want to encourage. The reason I say it in public is because it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because the Beis Din turns around and says, we have the power of a Beis Din, that we can be mafkia your kedushin. We can make it that you were never married to start with. How do we do that? So according to some opinion, how did me and my wife get married? I gave her a ring. I say, Harei Mekudeshes Li B'Taba'azu, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. The Beis Din will say, we can make it that you never owned that ring. Because Hefker Beis Din, we make it ownerless, so you were never married to her. So ha-ha. Now she doesn't have two husbands. Now who's laughing? It's very interesting. If that didn't give you enough of a headache, try this. This was a famous case in the last century. There was a situation where a husband went missing. The old-fashioned aguna, a Beis Din paskin that she can get remarried. Wonderfully religious woman, marries a wonderfully religious man. They go on to have two more children, and all of a sudden the first husband shows up again. What's the status? The status is that she has to divorce both husbands, and the children are mamzerim. A terrible situation. Is there any way out of that? So an idea was offered up that perhaps, again, everyone feels terrible, right? The first husband, the second husband, the woman, the children. Nobody really did anything wrong. But because of the strange turn of events, the Beis Din thought that he was gone. The Beis Din was wrong. So the first husband, some of them had the following suggestion. Perhaps the first husband should give a get by shliach to the wife at this point, and then be mevatel the shliach. Therefore, the Beis Din will knock out the first marriage, and therefore, the second marriage will be good and the kids will be fine. So this was a major discussion at the time. But we know the bottom line, the reason we've raised this issue is because it's our idea that the Beis Din has a right to be mafkir. So, based on the idea that the Beis Din can be mafkir, that the judiciary can do that, so the idea is that the governing body has the din, the status of a Beis Din, and as such, since it has a status of a Beis Din, the governing body has a right to take your taxes. So that's approach number two. It's not the melech that does it, it's the Beis Din that does it. Number three is the most interesting one. It seems simple, but the Ran himself points out that it's very strange. Number seven is, there's another reason why it's offered up, you can tax. Why is that? Who owns this great country? This land is my land, this land is your land. Well, the government really owns this great country, and therefore they have a right to charge me rent. If I want to live in this country, you can charge me for that. So therefore, taxes are a form of rent, and rent can be whatever amount. You know, I can turn to you and say, this is what I demand. If you don't like it, doors open, have a good time. The Ran points out that even though this is a very compelling approach, it's problematic in one country in particular, and that is the land of Israel. We believe that we all own part of the land of Israel. So if I would want to live in Israel, you can't make me pay for that. So the Ran himself points out that, of course, that would mean that the government in Israel would not have the right to tax. Okay. I understand there are people who follow the opinion of the Ran. Some of them even know they're following the opinion of the Ran. But that's also probably not likely. Rav Shecht always points out that even according to the Ran, okay, so then, but who gives you the right to use the services? Right? The fact that you're using the services in the country, that requires the payment as well. The last approach, which is also an interesting approach, is the idea is that there is a partnership between all Americans between all the members of the great city of Chicago, between all the members of the great state of Illinois. We all get together, we all make agreements among ourselves, we have elections go by majority vote, right? In these elections we can decide to tax, in these elections we can decide to appoint people who have the power to tax. Basically we've made an agreement when we move into this country, we've into the state, into this locality, whoever's paying taxes, basically we have accepted this upon ourselves, just like we accepted all laws, we have accepted taxes upon ourselves, and therefore with that, we agree and we are legally obligated to pay whatever our share is. So these are basically the overview of view of taxes. Why is there a right to tax? Unclear. Four approaches. All approaches have their pluses and minuses, but at the end of the day, we definitely believe that we do have an obligation to pay our taxes. Now, that being said, we had mentioned earlier on that taxes need to be fair taxes. And to a certain extent, I punted on that. But to a certain extent, I'd like to come back to that because there's a very interesting machlokes which directly affects the case that we are discussing. If you look at the Gemara in Bava Basra, the Gemara in Bava Basra is discussing, in number 9, the case of limiting suppliers. Oftentimes, let's say, for example, I'm a shoe salesman. I'm a shoe salesman in this area. I want to keep out foreign competition. So when can you do it? When can't you do it? This is, of course, it's interesting. There are many, throughout the country, there are many famous cases of Hasagas Gvul, generally involving restaurants, which is surprising. I haven't heard a lot of them here. I'm sure they exist, and I'm sure people will be happy to share them with me. I have no doubt about that. But you always have, in the Beis Din, we have a pretty fairly brisk business in Hasagas Gvul, where I own a burger joint here, I own a pizza store, I own a grocery store, you want to open it next to my Svarim store, etc. So when can you hold back? When can you not hold back? So the Gemara in Baba Basra gives very specific rules, and it tells the story of Hannah Dikoy, the Isle Dikoy of Bavel. There were people who were basket weavers. They brought their baskets to Bavel. Also, b'nei Masa kama akvi alayu. The people of the city said, "No, I'm sorry, you can't sell your wares here. We have the monopoly. We are the basket sellers of the area." Also, kamei the Ravina. They went to Ravina. Amruhu me alma also alma lizvenu. So he says, no, he said, you know, in general, buyers are coming from everywhere, so sellers can come from everywhere. So he says, when there is a time, Yom of the Shuka, the day that of the bazaar, of when everyone would come and buy, so since there are buyers from outside of the area, you have to allow also in sellers from outside of the area. But when it's not this day, the Yom of the Shuka, then not. And even those days, you can only come to the convention center and sell there. You can't go door to door, where that's the local market. So that's what he says. He goes on with another case, etc. So there is a concept out there which says that there is an ability for what we would call protectionism. That the producers in the local area have a right to stop competition from coming in. The Ri Magash, one of the most underrated Rishonim out there, the Ri Magash is very important for his location in the Masorah. The Shulchan Aruch, which we're all familiar with, has a general rule. The general rule is when there's a Machokas Rishonim, he looks at three opinions, and when it comes to Halacha, he takes two out of three. Who are the three opinions? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. Those are the three halachic commentaries, shall we say, on the Gemara. And he always goes with two out of three. And they point out that it's really not fair because two of them tend to always go together. The Rif and the Rambam always tend to say the same thing. They're representing the Sephardic view as opposed to the Rush. Tends to be on the outs. What's the relationship between the Rif and the Rambam? So the Rif was the Rambam's grand Rebbe. How does that work? Well, the Rif was the Rebbe of the Ri Magash, and the Ri Magash was the Rebbe of the Rambam. So the Ri Magash is a very important person. Unfortunately, we're missing most of his works. We have his Perish on a very few Masechtas. We have Baba Basra, we have Shavuos. In the last 10 years, they found Kedushin. You know, bits and pieces are trickling back, but we don't have a lot of Ri Magash, but that we have is very important. So the Ri Magash makes an important statement. The Ri Magash introduces something which is really a key idea, and that is a third-party beneficiary. The Ri Magash says you can only stop competition from coming in a case where it's not going to affect the third-party beneficiary. Who is the third-party beneficiary here? The consumer. Right? In general, competition is something that is very good for the consumer. I was an economics major in yeshiva, also not mentioned, I will note. But me, Rabbi Yitzhak Cohen, a long line of important economics majors at the yeshiva. So basic economics is competition leads to two things. It leads to lower prices and better product. So the Ri Magash makes the point that while we have a right to protect the local producers, it can't be off the back of the local consumer. And as such, he makes the point that in the event that this would, if they are producing at a lower price, that would lead us to hurt a third party. In that case, you cannot stop the outsiders from coming in because you have to be concerned about the consumer as well. The Ramban comments on this, so I'll just mention, when I was an economics major in yeshiva, my economics Rebbe, and in many ways my Rebbe, was Rabbi Aaron Levine, Olav HaShalom, who passed away a year and a half ago, a tremendous loss. A young man who, outstanding in what he did, somebody who has not been replaced, and there's no one who's going to come close in the near future as far as we can tell. Rabbi Levine pointed out that this Ramban encapsulates the basis of economics. The Ramban says as follows. The Ramban makes the point that there is no such thing. What the Ri Magash is talking about is non-existent. It is impossible that you have a situation where you stop competition and prices do not change because of it. It's basic economic supply and demand. The greater the supply, if you keep a steady demand, you will lower the price. Those are all those charts that you always look at. Right? If this is the supply curve, right? This is the price. If that is the supply curve, steeper, the price is going to go down. So what the Rami Margash says, that the Gemara is only talking about a situation where the price is unaffected by the lack of competition, he's describing a case which cannot exist. And since this case cannot exist, that can't be what the Gemara is talking about. You can't tell me that Gemara is limited to a case where stopping the competition will not lower the price, because there is no such case. The fact that the Gemara made the point indicates that the Gemara is not bothered by this. So therefore, the Ramban makes an important point. The Ramban says, what I think he is saying, and this is really driven home by the Namukhe Yosef, is that there's two types of price drops. There's the natural price drop, which will be not big. Again, if instead of a million widgets, economics, because we're always making widgets, right? A million widgets will sell at $1 each. Now if I have 1.2 million widgets, it goes down to 95 cents a widget, that's not significant. However, if Chinese widgets sell at 60 cents each, for whatever reason, right? That's what you can't stop. So again, the Ramban asked this question, the Namukhe Yosef gives the answer and says that there is a difference. The difference is, what type of effect are we talking about? A minor effect on prices, that we can protect the producers for. If it's going to be a major effect, then all bets are off. Now, let's take that back to our case. Taxes in general. We spoke about the four different categories of why taxes are allowed, etc. The idea being that the purpose of taxes is to support the government. Right? Well, a government tax is because everybody in the country needs to benefit, and therefore everyone in the country needs to pay. More or less, right? People that benefit a little more, they pay a little more, they pay a lot more, whatever it is, but that's the basic idea. The power of taxes, no matter how you slice it, is a power to run society. You might be able to have a volunteer firefighter someplace, but you can't have a volunteer government in general. Right? You can't have a volunteer army. You can't say, okay, who wants to pick up the garbage next week? Who wants to plow the streets? Right? Who wants to take care of the parks? It's just not going to work. You need to have this. You need to run society. But looking at the case of the gefilte fish tariff, who was paying it and who was getting it? Ultimately, who was paying the money for the gefilte fish tariff? The consumer, the gefilte fish consumer. Right? A very narrow group had to pay this. Who was getting the money? Well, the Kinneret fishermen, correct. Right? If you look at the tariff was not a case of normal taxation, it was a case of income redistribution. We were taking money away from the gefilte fish consumer, and we were putting it in the pocket of the fishermen. Is that allowed? So if you look at the Gemara in Baba Basra, we see that even though taxes in general are allowed, a tax, which is just basically protecting one group at the expense of another group, is not allowed. Perhaps a de minimis amount you're allowed to do, right? Again, I understand why it makes sense to buy American, right? I want Americans to be low in unemployment. I want the other people. I want people to pay taxes. I don't want to have to pay unemployment insurance for them. I'd be willing to pay a few pennies extra, so this guy in America will have the job. But there's a limit, right? If it's a matter of $1 to 95 cents, right? Then the Namukhe Yosef says, fine. Yes, I understand that protectionism is going to cost me a few pennies. But when it's such a different, when the quality of the product or the price of the product is that radically different, that's not really worth it for me at all, at that point the tax becomes illegal. That has to be stopped. Going back to the gefilte fish case, what was the difference? 90 cents to $2 a pound, right? On 12 million pounds. That's not de minimis. That's already above and beyond. So, based on this, assuming we go with this, one would have to say that Hillary Clinton's right and Israel's wrong. I'm sure not a lot of people get up and say that here in often, and live to talk about it. But the bottom line is, when it comes to protectionist policies like this, it would seem that this is something that the Gemara does not look positively on. We'll end off by looking at the Shulchan Aruch. So how does the Shulchan Aruch paskin? The Shulchan Aruch follow the Rima Gash, that in fact the consumer has to be looked out for, or does he follow the opinion of the Ramban that the consumer is not considered? So in Choshen Mishpat, Hasochim Shemevian Scharosum Limchor Betoch Hayaros, people who go from city to city to sell their wares. You can stop them from going door to door. But on the Yom Hashuk, like the Gemara says, you can't stop them. This is all just a quote from the Gemara in easier Hebrew. If they have business in the area, if they owe money in the area, they have a right to sell right away. So the Shulchan Aruch does not take sides in this. However, looking at the Ramah, which the Bnei Ashkenaz are very interested in, so he said, same thing, money lending is the same as any other business. Here we go. The only time that this is allowed is in the event that the consumer will not be affected. This is only in a situation where that product is no better than the other products. However, aval im nosim yoser bazol, however, if they are offering a cheaper price, osha yoser tova, or if they have better product, in that case, they cannot be stopped from selling if their price is significantly lower or the quality is significantly better. In those situations, we care about the consumer more than we care about the producer, and therefore we look out for the third-party beneficiary, and they do not have the right to do this. I quote on the bottom the Piskei Tshuva, who quotes that there is a difference, he quotes in the Mukhei Yosef, between the minimis and not. But again, that would not make a difference in our case. So in sum, I'd like to say that I'm sure many of you have heard a lot about the Asian carp crisis. This might have been an eye-opener, the Israeli involvement in it. And in general, it's important to understand the underpinnings of any halacha, but in taxation in particular. And this should give us a general idea. As I pointed out, no one has asked me this question yet. But then again, we have these hopes that soon enough, with the coming of the Mashiach, the laws of Israel will switch to the laws of Halacha once again. And at that time, I'm sure they'll be banging down my doors for my opinions on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any questions?
Any questions before Rav heads back?